Welcome to the Filmmaker Mixer Podcast, the podcast by filmmakers for filmmakers. My name is Andrew, and I'm joined alongside my co-host, Jeff, as always. Jeff and I are writers and directors and passionate about the art of storytelling. Filmmaker Mixer is a creative hub where aspiring and established filmmakers come together to share experiences, insights, strategies, and inspiration. Today we have on the show filmmaker Melinda Merker and producer David Miller from the film We Live Here, The Midwest.
Hello, everybody. This is the Filmmaker Mixer podcast, and today we are talking to director Melinda Merker and producer David Miller about their new documentary, which is on Hulu, We Live Here, The Midwest. So, David and Melinda, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I guess let's start here. I'm curious, what are your backgrounds? How did you get interested? We'll start with you, Melinda, and I want to hear from you as well, David. How did you get interested in filmmaking? Did you always want to do documentaries? Were you always a storyteller? Were you interested in film as a kid or a teenager? How did that start for you, Melinda?
I was about five.
Oh, wow.
And my dad let me use his camera, you know, the manual cameras at the time. And it was just, you know, it was fascinating to me to look through a lens. And I've always been driven by storytelling, period. But I've worked in ways in the visual arts that have combined storytelling from a narrative perspective with visual media. So, yes, it started very young and telling stories. Yeah.
What was your first film when you were five or six?
Oh, God. Well, I do remember this. It was The Thing, and it scared me to death for 2 years, literally. because parents did not pay attention to their children, my parents let me watch it, and then my grandpa took me to Jaws. And that scared me to death for another 3 years. So, you know, but all that goes to say, you see the power of filmmaking, you know, to for better or worse, to have an emotional impact.
I was curious, what kinds of things did you film when you were that age, when you first started working with that camera? Did you have movie ideas then at that young age?
I had ideas that I wanted things to move. So it wasn't just a still image.
Interesting.
But no one's going to want to hear this, but I was doing a puppet show. And I would take photos of the puppet show, you know, and try to get, you know, that sort of narrative going and just storytelling, but again wanting it in two dimensions. I remember I got to direct a play in New York in my 20s and off Broadway, and I thought, wow, I love working with the actors, and the person who wrote the play, it was very good, but I wanted the right shots, so seeing it perform live was very frustrating. And I love the surface too of visual media. And I worked as a creative director as my day job for years, and working with designers and photographers. And, you know, I realized I didn't want to hold the equipment. That was not my skill set. But to work with talented people who have that skill set and to have that vision and bring it forward in a visual way.
Interesting.
Yeah. And David, what about you?
Sadly, I did not play with puppets.
Hey, it's never too late.
Exactly. As a child,
Yeah, I don't even think as a child. You know, the transformative film for me was Ordinary People way back when.
Oh, good one.
I saw that film and I thought, wow, that has affected me on such a visceral, emotional level. And the idea that cinema or film can do that to somebody was really got me passionate and excited about that. And so I was able to land a job as a PA and worked my way through many films, you know, on big time films like Steven Spielberg, Sidney Pollack, Richard Attenborough, and then eventually produced two small independent features, and then had some personal issues that took me away from film, and then came back as a location scout for many years on commercials, and then decided that I wanted to pursue photography and stuck with that and learned lighting and how to do that. And, you know, did some stuff for some magazines. And then that is in fact how Melinda and I met, and we were doing some film video projects for some nonprofits. And then the 2016 election came and we said, uh-oh, we have something more to do and something more to pursue.
And where are you guys based, real quickly? I forgot to ask that.
Yeah, I was born and raised in Los Angeles.
Gotcha.
I was not born and raised here, but I've lived here in Los Angeles for quite a while.
Yeah, I'm curious too. You guys kind of both talked about early on in your career. I'm curious a little bit before that, did either of you go to film school, or what was that kind of foundation like before you kind of jumped into, you know, early on in your careers?
Yeah, you know, when I was working on as a PA, we were all set to go on location, and I was going to go, and the producer pulled me aside and said, "Listen, you know, you're on board, and I'm ready to take you, but you really need to get a college education, and I think that that would be more important." And I said, "Okay, I'll do that, but what am I going to do?" And he goes, "Well, pursue film." And so I worked my way into USC Film School and went to film school there.
And Melinda, what about you?
I had a very traditional liberal arts education, which was fantastic, you know, and majored in English and art history, which gave, again, the verbal visual combination. And I did want to go to film school. I moved to France after college for a few years and got to work on a television show. It was really exciting. And when I came back, I wanted to do that. And honestly, I couldn't afford it. And I just thought, I'm going to be in debt for 3,000 years. and that was scary. And I started work on my first documentary. It was a short about women pilots who flew in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And
oh, how interesting.
It was, well, no one else thought so, but thank you. no one else thought so. But I learned so much from that. And I just decided, okay, you'll do this on your own. And for me, well, I would have loved film school. My three most successful friends in Hollywood, directors and writers, have not gone to film school. So I felt a little better about that. You know, I would have enjoyed it, but I realized it wasn't going to derail a career.
Well, you know, I'm curious about that because one of the things we always talk about on the show is how what we call building your tribe, you know, and a lot of people who go to film school meet other filmmakers and find out who they want to work with and don't want to work with and so on. And sometimes they continue to work with those same folks. So I'm curious, Melinda, in your case, since you didn't go to film school, did you, through your other projects, like your first documentary and things like that, did you meet other filmmakers that you built relationships with that you still work with today? And if so, how did that happen?
Not from that early on, and that was in New York, and I ended up in Los Angeles, but I did have mentors, many of whom are younger than me, which is humbling, but good. I write a lot of screenplays, so that's my other passion, and I've had sort of high-level master classes with friends who have, you know, come in and taught me a lot, and I think the same on the photography level. I was an assistant in France and worked with fashion photographers and decided, again, I should not be holding the camera literally, but I learned so much. I wouldn't say, but your question was about have I maintained that community? Yes, in LA over the last 15 years, yes. Before that, no. But you know, you find like-minded people. David and I have been working together, God, 10 years, and you find people you just want to keep working with.
And how did you two meet?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to jump in real quickly to say, you know, as somebody who did go to film school, you do not need to go to film school to make films.
Especially probably today with all the access to equipment that we have. It's amazing. You can.
Absolutely. I mean, if you have the talent, you know, I mean, the thing is you just got to do things, you know, you just got to write a script. You just got to go out. You got to do a horrible job and fail and fail and fail. And then eventually, you know, you're going to start meeting other people that are in the same, have the same passion as you are. You're going to learn from them. Film school is definitely not the only avenue to great film.
I'm curious what led to the genesis of this particular project, We Live Here in the Midwest.
Well, as David mentioned very briefly, we had been working with this nonprofit, and the nonprofit, the focus was LGBTQ families. And, you know, there were little video projects and photos for a book, and it was very sweet. You know, gay marriage had passed. It felt very joyful. How are people, expanding their families within that environment? You know, together we thought, gosh, we should look at a film that tells some of these stories.
Well, one of the things I'm curious about, especially when, you know, we talk about documentaries that have, you know, such interesting subject matter, one of the keys is putting your subjects in a safe space where you can really let them, you know, process and talk about their lives and open up. And I guess it just takes the right bedside manner in order to create that. But I'm curious, Melinda, as a director, and also I'd like to hear from you, David, as the producer, what's your process to make your subjects comfortable and really get deep into the conversation?
I think it's two things. One is time and getting to know people over months, you know, through Zoom, et cetera, and phone calls before.
So there's a lot of work that goes in, like
a lot of pre-production.
Interesting.
Yeah. A lot of work. And then once you're there, I find that honestly, revealing something about yourself, you know, just being present in a way that's vulnerable for yourself, that then people feel, oh, that's okay. You know, if you're doing that, that's fine. You know, not in a weird way, but clothes stay on. But, you know, you're saying, okay, this was hard for me when I was a kid, or maybe a experience you had at school where you were bullied, even if it wasn't for the exact same reason, you can relate to that and you can give that experience. And then, you know, people know that you're on the same page emotionally with them in that way.
Yeah. And I think so much prep work had been done that by the time we entered the home, I think they felt very safe with us. You know, we also came in there knowing, like, you know, we're these Hollywood people that are coming into their private homes and who knows how they're going to be exposed. So we really wanted them to feel safe. And obviously, you know, the more vulnerabilities we could express allowed them to be equally vulnerable.
And what about like crew footprint? Does that have any effect on that? Or does it matter how many, you know, crew members you bring in to?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is you want to make it as small as possible. You know, I mean, right. You don't want a lot of people scraping through the home. I mean, we had a sound man, a cameraman, and an assistant, and me and Melinda. You know, that was it. When we were on the road, obviously we had an editor and, you know, other things later on down the road. But when we were filming, it was just, you know, the core five and we bonded amongst ourselves, you know, and that was, we had some good times.
Well, we had, what was it? I think 4 Leos out of 5 people. Not that.
Oh, wow.
For anyone out there who's vaguely into astrology, and I'm vaguely into astrology, it still struck me. I'm like, wow.
That you is know, interesting.
These are some people with strong, you know, opinions and drive. Yeah. <You know. laughs> and I was with a bunch of men. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I want to kind of stay on the production side of things real quick. You know, we have a lot of listeners who are really interested in the nuts and bolts of filmmaking. So I know you spoke a little bit about your crew, but I'm curious, you know, what the entire scope of the shoot was, how many days was it besides your crew members? You know, what kind of maybe difficulties did you run to? And like you're saying, maybe there were some memorable moments that got made out of it.
I mean, filming was over the course of a month. Once we hit the road, we just stayed on the road. We had one situation where we were ready to go to Wisconsin to film a family and they backed out 2 days before we were supposed to go. So there was a scramble of having to, one, find an additional family and then have to, you know, rearrange rental cars, flights. You know, that was a mad dash. But it all came together. 2 cameras were used on the project, you know, various lenses. Sound man had all his gear. And then, you know, I also shot photography behind the scenes as well as portraiture. So I had my own camera for that. Very small lighting and grip for the interviews. I think it was maybe three, mostly two lights for that. And then I had my own strobes. And then what else production-wise? I mean,
I had a clipboard.
Yeah. Melinda had a clipboard. She said that she would move the gear, but she did not.
It was in good faith that I would do that. And then, it's really heavy.
Yeah. And then we had an assistant, you know, then we had an assistant that helped us out, you know, and, you know, provided, got us lunches and stuff like that. Because once we were, you know, one of the things we found is that when we were rolling the cameras and we were, you know, deep into it and, you know, we didn't know really all was going to come out. You don't want to necessarily leave, you know, break everything down and walk away to lunch. So it's kind of like, you know, I'd slip the guy, you know, or the assistant Austin a note and go grab us lunch so that, you know, when he came back, we could continue filming and get this great footage that we got.
Right. Well, you know, I want to pivot back to you, Melinda. I know a lot of times with documentaries, you know, you've got the core idea and you've got the subject matter, but sometimes you create the narrative from what you gather in the shoot. And so I'm curious, is that the way you approach this? Did you come up with these subjects and then, you know, shoot a lot of these interviews and you know, the backstories, and then figure out where you wanted to go? Or did you have an idea? I guess what I'm asking is, did you figure out the story in the edit, or did you have the story kind of worked out in terms of the direction you wanted to go with the documentary when you started? I don't know if that makes sense or not, but
yeah, it does. It does. And when we started, and with the research, already you have an idea of stories you want to tell. And I felt in speaking to people, certain themes came through, you know, bullying for one, being essentially ousted from your church being another. So we were looking at stories that included those issues, but it's not an issue-driven film. It's a story-driven film. So then it became, yeah, where is there a narrative arc here in each of these stories? So you go in to me with a narrative arc, and you know, as you're listening to the beats that you need in that story. On the other hand, I feel like be so prepared that you can let it go when something, a really interesting left turn happens.
Oh, interesting. Did that happen?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's what's, you know, very exciting about filmmaking. You know, I think, and I think, David, we have the same, you know, moments, one of which was Katie and Nia in the first segment on Iowa. Nia's a trans woman, Katie's queer, and talking about her leaving the church. We knew she had left the church. We didn't know how emotional that was going to be. So while it was going to be, for me, something you just touch on, it became something to delve into.
Oh, interesting.
In a greater way.
Yeah. And I mean, that was pretty powerful. And I think another moment was in Minnesota. You know, it was not our, we didn't go there thinking we were going to film Trish, the ex-wife. And it really wasn't until the morning of that we were going to film her daughters because of Jen, where we thought, oh, it would be very good to get her perspective and her on this. And so we added in that. And then that's sort of where the story changed a little bit, because we realized, oh, we have a much bigger picture. We have more to tell than we originally had thought we were going to tell.
And that's the joy of documentary filmmaking, the panic and the joy. You lose something that you know, but again, I think being fully prepared enables you to go somewhere. If you're fully prepared and know what you want, it enables you, ironically, to be in the moment. So you're not scrambling. You know, if we didn't know, that would be really hard. How do you know where to take a left turn if you're not even on the road?
Well, I guess that gets back to what you were saying. You know, you knew thematically what the story should be. And so I guess knowing that theme helps you be able to pivot in the moment, I suppose.
The theme as well as the narrative.
Right.
You know, each story has to have even, you know, a beginning, middle, and end. And that happens, you know, as David mentioned, in the pre-production process, certainly is happening while you're filming, that you're in the moment. And then in the editing, in the post-production, again, certain beats that you thought this is great, you get there and you're like, doesn't resonate as much as we had hoped. So that becomes something you work with too. But I think from the get, you always have to have a strong story that's driving you, and then the willingness to open up to changes while filming and changes while editing. But it's still pretty much stuck to, I'm trying to think, I don't think there was an instance, David, was there an instance where we just, you know, we had a story and it completely shifted? I don't think so.
No. Yeah, no. No, we obviously made some adjustments in editing and whatnot. But there was no big, wow, we got this one wrong.
God. Well, we thought we were making a film about turtles, and then suddenly
yeah
we went, geez, this is not interesting, we should be making a film about gay families.
I'm you know, staying on the editing question, I'm curious, because you guys were on the road or traveling a lot, did you have someone editing the footage like while you shot it, so you could see what it was turning out to be in terms of finding the story, or was that all found afterwards, after shooting was done?
Yeah, I mean, I would love to have been able to have that option to, you know, check it out, the footage while we were on the road. But no, you know, we were a small crew and we didn't have a lot of money to do this. And so we had an editor that was able to assist us while she was doing other things. So we didn't, you know, once we came back from the road, we turned in all the hard drives to her and then, you know, she went through her process. And the editing, of course, took longer than we had thought. You know, obviously got it done. Just everything just took longer in terms of the editing.
And something you said, Melinda, about trying to maybe tell a story first and foremost. I know documentaries often aim to educate and also entertain, you know, maybe for aspiring documentarians or even seasoned ones. How do you strike a balance between those two elements?
That's a good question. I think that story, if no matter what the subject is, if there isn't a story driving it, it's very hard to pay attention. It's hard to be engaged. It's hard to be certainly engaged on an emotional level. If I'm just getting information educationally, again, it may be interesting, but I'm not going to fall into that. That humanizing issues, telling stories is what we do. You know, that's the joy of filmmaking. As opposed to simply educating. I think if that happens in the process of, you know, emotionally feeling the story, that's a great bonus.
Well, I'm curious, how did the Hulu release happen? I mean, that's a pretty big deal.
You know, our agent was able to get it to somebody at Hulu who, you know, then showed it to somebody else. And the next thing we know, we had an appointment with them. And, you know, we were... It was originally our intention to do, and we still would like to, do the entire United States. You know, we wanted to go region by region. And when Hulu saw it, they really responded enthusiastically to this. And they said, you know, we would love to get this out there to an audience now. And our first reaction was like, but it's not done yet.
Yeah, what stage was this? Were you...
We had music down. I mean, we didn't have main and end credits, but we had the music down. It was edited. We thought it was pretty, you know, pretty wrapped up.
Was your picture totally locked at this point?
Well, no, I mean, it was locked in the sense that we did, the picture. I mean, we didn't have end credits and right. all that stuff and this.
But you were happy with the narrative or the story.
Very happy. Yeah, okay. I mean, I would not have wanted somebody to see it unless it was at a point where we were really happy.
Gotcha.
Yeah, because you don't want to give an impression of like, oh, well, we can fix that later, because first impression is huge, unless they're a really seasoned person and know about the editing process. So it was very important for us to get it really tight and how we wanted it to be presented.
And with this being our first, you know, broadcast documentary, it was, yeah, you want to come in and say, we can pull it off. I think that was very important that we come in with a locked picture idea. We were open to changes, certainly, but we wanted to say, this is where we've gotten it. We feel good about it. And let us know what you think.
So was Hulu always the end goal when you guys started off the film, or did you have any kind of distribution in mind? I'm always curious about that end when you're kind of coming up with the project.
Well, the correct political answer is, of course, it was Hulu. That's all whoever ever thought of. Hulu was certainly up there. I mean, you know, Hulu, Netflix, Amazon, you know, Max. I mean, those were always sort of the goals. You know, I guess we got a little bit of luck and we sort of went straight to one of the top ones there and they liked it. So we took it.
Tell people where they can find the film. I know it's out now, and if they're interested in seeing the film, where can they find it?
Hulu.
I knew that answer. And if they're interested in the other things you're working on, how do they follow you, Melinda, and you, David, if they're interested in your career or your other projects? Are you guys Instagram people? Are you Facebook? How do people follow your work?
Well, we do have a website, dcmdocumentary.com. At the moment, that is just filled with the current release. But we will be adding, you know, news to that and other other events and things that we're cooking up. But at the moment, we're just focused on the launch of We Live Here Right Now.
Gotcha.
And my Instagram is mostly my dogs. So apparently I've been encouraged to change that.
Well, you know, as an animal lover myself, I sympathize with that. I think dogs and cats and anything on Instagram is good. Well, very good. Yeah. Well, definitely keep us in the loop on the project as it moves forward and on anything else you're working on, because our door is always open. If you've got something new you're working on, we'd love to chat with you some more.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, guys. You know,
and this is great, hopefully for all your listeners too, to get some insight. I wish I had some of this when I was younger.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we appreciate your time and you guys take care.
Thank you.
You too.
Thank you for listening to the Filmmaker Mixer podcast, a podcast created and hosted by filmmakers Jeff Stolen and Andrew Lamping and produced by Melody Lopez.
Our theme song was composed by Stephen D. Bennett.
Make sure to follow or subscribe on whatever platform you're listening to us on and stay tuned for future episodes.